was born in Cardinal Place, Ontario, and we moved to Winnipeg about 1930. And I was working for the Trust and Guarantee Company before the war. And so when the war started, quite surprised, because you know nobody expects the war to start so soon. So I said to my mother, "Well, what do you think about me joining?" She said, "Well, she said it's better to join up voluntarily than to be conscripted." I said, "Well, that's true enough." So I went up to Mitchell Armories, and so I was met at the door by a sergeant in a long red scarf. He said, "You're going to join up?" I said, "Yes, I think so." He said, "Follow me, I got the place for you." So I followed him, and he marched me right in the office of the Grenadiers. And he says, "We've got a good man here for you." So Paddy Keenan was there, the RSM, and so they signed me up. Yeah? This particular day, you see, it was a Grenadier sergeant that was on duty. If I had went up another day, it might have been the Princess Pat's early sergeant, you see. So it just happened that I suppose whichever early sergeant was on duty, he would escort the people into his own particular office, for his regiment.
Did you know
No, I knew nothing about the army, or nothing about it at all, and I was absolutely clueless as to what to expect or anything. So I didn't know, and I never knew anyone either. But once I was in there, I met a couple of people that I did know. Oh yeah, yeah. That's right. Although once I was in the army, I did regret that I didn't go into the Air Force once I found out everything. But I never knew such a thing as an Air Force existed. Well, I think so, because nobody knew about the Air Force, and a number of soldiers in our outfit said the same thing. If they only had it known, they would have joined the Air Force. Oh yeah, she was a machine gun trainer. We were supposedly a machine gun regiment. But we had good training, and because of this training, we were picked from, I guess, most of the regiments in Canada to go to the garrison in Jamaica to guard the political prisoners there. But that was only because we were so well trained at that time. Oh yeah. They not only did have to guard the prisoners there, but keep up with our parade work and training, rifle training, and everything else. So we weren't there for a holiday by any means. Therefore, do a job. And I suppose because we're already doing a job outside of Canada, maybe that's why we were picked to go to Hong Kong. I was in battalion headquarters. Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, oh yeah. They're like brothers. Oh yeah. Fine bunch of young fellows. Oh yeah. Yeah, good. From Jamaica, he came back in the fall, and after being in Jamaica for a year or so, he found it quite cold here. Mind you, it wasn't winter weather, but I think we got climatized to the climate down there. But when we got back here, we had to wear overcoats when we got back here. So we're just here for a short while to get outfitted, and then on our way again. No idea in the world. But we had a few suspicions. Of course, we never knew that we were going to Hong Kong, but once we issued us out the pith helmets and summer clothing like that, we had a feeling we may go to some temperate climate. Of course, we had no idea it'd be Hong Kong. But once we're on the boat, well into the trip, we had to practice rifle drill in the dark of the boat, because we had to travel with the lights off, you see, and the news got so bad before we got there, we were warned that we may have to fight our way off the boat. But fortunately, we didn't. Well, they didn't know what the situation was going to be, because Hong Kong is so close to the mainland, it's just across the bay. And things can happen so fast when you're that close. So they told us that you may have to fight your way off the boat. You don't know. Well, not too happy. But in those days, when you're young, everything is exciting. Mind you, war is not... war is exciting in itself when you're young. Although I think for older people it may not be. But there is an element of excitement, no doubt. Oh yeah, yeah. When you're young, you're prepared to do anything, and the main thing is you're prepared to do what you're told to do. With a regiment that's well trained, they do exactly what they're told. Well, the approach to Hong Kong is a very dreary, strictly oriental look. The approach is long through a sort of a channel with bare rock and really barren look. It's got the oriental look. I wasn't prepared to see so many thousands of Chinese lining the streets. It was really amazing, the number of Chinese walking around. But it was exciting. Oh yes. Oh yes, yeah. Oh yes. People laying all around the streets, sleeping, and kids asking you for money. We found out that the hard way, when you go downtown, the kids will crowd around you, you see. Dozens, I'll say. But by the time you leave them, you don't have anything left in your pockets, because they just pick your pockets. And there's such a crowd of them, you don't expect it of them, you see. Oh, that was funny. No. No, not much time at all. We just barely seen the city. And we went for, my brother and I went for a walk on the street of Thieves, and we bought some souvenirs. No, it's a street, it's a long street, and a lot of shops, and most of the goods are stolen, and you can buy various things quite cheaply. And my brother bought some things, and I bought some articles, jewelry and stuff, but of course we had to give them up before the war was over. But it was exciting. The smells were really oriental. It was exciting. Oh yeah, really exciting for Westerners. Something you never expect to see in your lifetime. Oh yeah, it's always trains. Every day, there's not a day goes by that not only do you do your drill, rifle drill, you do your physical training as well. First thing in the morning, 6 o'clock in the morning, you're out there doing PT, jumping around. A lot of big heads, but still, they were done. Well, I guess a soldier, to be effective, he's got to be in good health to do a job. Well, mainly they had a volunteer band that that we played in before we got there, and then once we got there, we did stretcher bearing work. Well, and then that's what we were scheduled to do, and then once we went over to Hong Kong, we just did the normal. A rifle and anything like that. Mortar. Yes, we went over there once or twice. And the last time we were there, I think my brother and I was in a movie, and they announced every at all the grandees to go back to camp immediately. So we all went back, and they announced that we were going over to Hong Kong for exercise. What an exercise it turned out to be. No, not a bit. Nobody had any idea at all. So I don't know if it was that night or in the morning. I'm not sure. But we all went over to Hong Kong. And we went up in our positions, various positions. And I got the guard duty about early in the morning. I was on guard duty. I suppose I stood out there, maybe started my round of duty about 5 o'clock. And just at daybreak, and all this noise, and over to the south, all these airplanes coming over. I said, oh boy, look at that. That looks good. And so they come over, and all of a sudden these things started dropping like this. I couldn't figure it out. So, but when they started to explode, then then I knew what was happening. But you know, it was so confounding, because there's no clue, no... I don't believe anybody knew that that they were prepared to attack Hong Kong. I believe it was a surprise attack like Pearl Harbor. And then the battleships just laid off the shore and shelled us. Yeah? Well, it started once the planes went over, then the battleships took over. And I don't know, I think these shells from the battleships strike a lot harder than the bombs from the planes. But that was our exercise. No. Well, there was a headquarters, I guess. It was in a pillbox where the officers, I guess they were, where they had their headquarters. But that was shelled early in the war. And most of them died, I understand, in the one shelling. But this is various one-shy gap, I guess, standing on a little hill. Beautiful view, beautiful day. What a beautiful day it was. Okay. Yes, yeah, it was amazing. Well, the oh yes, that's for sure. The side I was on, it was too steep, I believe, for the Japs to land. As it was very steep, but the Japs landed over on the northeast side of the island. There was a beach there, and it took them some time to get over. But in the meantime, the Air Force is really pounding, and the battleships were shelling quite heavily. Oh yes, everyone there was responsible for their rifles. You know, they carried with you all the time. But our heavy armament never got there, I believe. And our jeeps and trucks never arrived. They were sidetracked somewhere else because of the Japanese planes or something. They were afraid they'd be sunk. But they were sidetracked someplace. I don't know where exactly, but they never did reach it. Well, we were split up into different companies and different groups because of the terrain. It was more or less like guerrilla fighting, you see, as it was all a mountainous area. Well, for one thing, I guess we didn't have any experience in that type of fighting, but it was awkward because it rained and rained and it gets slippery and everything. But I guess we did a good job, though, as far as I know. But, yeah, oh yeah. Yeah, or both, because as they have it so that there's a number, that there's an effective number of armament in one group, so you're going to do an effective job. But that was a pretty hopeless task, as well, outnumbered, outgunned, and we had no airplanes, or nothing. But it's amazing, even the Japanese admitted that they didn't expect to be held off as long as they did. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Good, yes. We were told that the governor of the island decided to surrender as the water supply in the city of Hong Kong was cut off and the power was cut off by the bombing. And he was afraid of disease and so on, and everything that goes with that. And he knew it was only a matter of time anyway before so he decided to surrender, and he ordered us to surrender. So we had to do it. No, we heard that they don't take prisoners. That's all we knew. So, well, I didn't like the idea at all. I guess no one did, because well, you know you're going to lose your freedom and possibly your life, but that was the order, and you have to follow orders regardless. So we all broke our rifles and threw the bolts away over the mountain and down the big cliffs and blew up our ammunition dump and destroyed everything we could possibly destroy of our armaments and equipment. And that's all we could do. And then we told her to go down, and we all walked down the mountain down towards the University of Hong Kong there, and we stayed one night in the university yards grounds, I should say. And then the next day we walked down to a city, and we stayed for a number of hours in a large parking lot, I guess, outside of the Bank of Hong Kong in the city. And then I guess they decided that it was a place where to stay at North Point Camp, so we went down there. I think they were a racing stable, horse stables, or something of that nature. It was a very crude and pretty rough accommodation. And no, not yet. They didn't bring down any of the wounded people at all.
They
were killing over. They didn't have any wounded at all. So I can only assume that they were killed. Oh, yes. I guess they were. Yeah, we stayed at North Point. That was a terrible place. Dead bugs and lice and everything. Terrible lice. Terrible. A big bit terrible. But we found a solution. outside there was big ant hills, red ants. And we brought in these ants and put them all over the beds. And they killed the lice and everything. Yes, it's amazing, yeah. And this is the camp where the four former Thanes escaped from North Point. And I tried to talk there, and one or two of it, but, and they tried to talk me into going, but I wouldn't have any part in it. I was so conspicuous in a land of yellow people, you know, short yellow people, that you just don't stand a chance, especially in a small boat. Where are you going to go in a small boat in a water that size? Yes, the escape went all right. They went over the wire at the back. I watched them go. And but the Japs got them in the middle of the bay. And we stood outside, and we stood on the lot for a couple of days, I guess. At attention, you couldn't move. And the Japs just walked up and down a big stick. Anybody that moved, they got a hit with the stick, a real good hit. So I guess it was 2 days, I think. I kind of forget. But it seemed to be ages. We just stood there. It was a fun thing, I guess. No. Well, the situation there wasn't like prisoners in Germany. You could escape in Germany and mingle with the crowd, and you just blend in. But in a place like Hong Kong, where everyone is Chinese except you, and you're white and tall, how are you going to blend in, especially if you don't know the language? That's another. So, not many fellows tried it. Well, I think the Chinese took a beating too. They were cruel to them, because we used to watch them, the Chinese going by on the streets. And they smartened up after a while. They'd walk by, and the guards would start doing brutal tricks on the poor Chinese, you know, these peasants, you see. And then they'd, and before you know it, their bodies would be floating down the river. And you'd see more bodies floating down the river with their hands tied behind their backs, and you'd see the silver. But they used to beat up on the Chinese that just walking by. Of course, there's something to do. Oh, yeah. No. You couldn't really fight for your own life, because the food is rationed out by the authorities. And you couldn't really scrounge any more food, and you couldn't buy any food, or you couldn't buy anything else. So everyone was equal, and they had the equal amount of food and anything else. So there wasn't anything that anyone could be envious of the other for. Which I think was good in one way. Same thing over in Shantipo when we got there. Once we got back to Shantipo from North Point, we arrived there and we couldn't recognize the place. Because all that was standing was the foundations. The Chinese moved in and stripped the place clean. And that's where we had to stay for a long time. So just before I went over there, over to Hong Kong, I bought a brand new Gruen watch at Brevard & Warren, a black face, long, and I loved it. brand new one. Boy, they lifted that off me. You know, they stood us up and they took rings off our fingers and our watches off and searched our pockets, anything we wanted. Pictures they'd tear up, stuff like that. No, not a thing. Not a thing. I don't think I had anything because they ripped up the pictures, stole my ring and my watch, and nothing in my wallet. No. We just I thought we had to wear, and then we had to watch our boots because they liked our boots, you know. Oh yeah, we had good boots. In fact, they were envious of our boots, and but all we had was just what we were standing in. I remember them trying to buy boots off us as guards, but I don't think any of the guys did, because I think there might have been one or two incidents where they did, but the guards were caught and they were punished, and really punished too. You know, there's no fooling around with Japanese guards, and because over there the corporal on parade, he can slap around a private. Sergeant can slap around a corporal, and this goes all the way up. So that's a matter of discipline, and they don't feel around. But some of the guys were able to keep their cigarette lighters, I guess. Well, a few odd things I think were kept. But very few. No. We couldn't retain anything like that because of the circumstances. But all we did was North Point. I think there was mattresses there or something. Sean Tripol, once we got back there, I don't think there was anything there as far as I know. I can't remember. But in Japan, once we got to Japan, we slept on straw mats. Not quite hard, but just a little bit of giving. And that's what we slept on for the length of time we were there. Yeah, no, we'll... no, it was raised up a little. Yeah, a little platform. But, and the straw mat seemed to be padded a little underneath. It wasn't hard as a rock, but it wasn't soft. But, as they say, sleeping on your board is good for you, that's what they claim. I'm glad I wasn't married at the time. Very glad. Very glad. But the, every so often the Japanese would give us news, would line us up, and the colonel would say, the people in Canada are starving to death. There's been a crop failure, and there's no bread for them to eat. And another time, he'd say, you soldiers work hard for Japan. He says, after we defeat Canada and the war is over, he says, if you work hard, we'll let you stay here and marry our girls. That looked dimmer all the time. we did see some girls while we were there, but not many, you know, from a distance, and they didn't appear to be the kind of girl you like to marry. No, I can't remember eating rice at all. I can't remember. But it, we never got clean rice until we got to Japan. As while we're at Shanshapo, the rice there is full of bugs, little bugs and things. I guess, I don't know what caused it, but maybe at the, I think the warehouse was bombed a couple of times, and the sacks of rice were broken open, and they were swept off the floor or something. Well, these little black bugs are just rice bugs, I don't know, but you tried to pick them out, but after a while you'd give up. Yes, while we're at North Point Camp, we'd get periods of different ailments. One time there'd be a rash of boils. Everybody would get boils all I got 5, 6, or 8 across my back all at one time, and the doctor just took his knife and lanced them, and that kind of tickled a little. And then they get sores in the mouth, all kinds of sores in the mouth, and yeah, but this is real bad. And what else? Oh yes, oh, difficulty procuring. That's where, this is just while we're at North Point, and we weren't there that long either, but this started there all of a sudden, I don't know why. But then once we got over to Shanshapo, and after a little while, then yellow jaundice started to become quite a worry, and as it was a serious type, that it would prevent breathing. And then we got various ailments, beriberi started to set in, and we all got what we called hot feet. Your feet would be burning like fire. And a lot of us used to stand on the cold cement or ground with our bare feet to, you know, relieve them, but that was bad, I understand, for them. Oh yeah, yeah, but that's for sure, that's bad. I still have it. Oh yes, and I still get pains in my feet, right in the middle of my feet. And even this day I have to sleep my feet out of the blankets at night. Oh yeah, that's bad. And then we got beriberi, various types. My brother got, what we referred to it as dry beriberi. That went into the bone. And it was, I think, more serious than what they call wet beriberi. I swelled up when I come back to Canada. My face is all swollen up, my hands and feet all swollen up with beriberi. And I don't know if that goes away completely or not, I have no idea. No, there was no sympathy from the Japanese at all. Well, not as far as we know. You know, they never expressed any, of course. But we had excellent doctors, but and they put themselves in jeopardy and everything else to try to get his medicine. But during the war, there's no doubt food was scarce, even for the Japanese, and I think medicine was scarcer. So we never got any medicine, even to counteract the yellow jaundice and so on. I think there's something else. I forget. I think there's something else that we got, but there's nothing. Diphtheria, yeah. Yeah. I think at the very beginning there might have been a few that got a treatment for it, but very few. And then a lot of boys died from it because they choked and they couldn't breathe. But there's no medicine. It's just if you survived, you survived. And there wasn't a lot of the doctors could do without medicine at all. But it helped. Even go and talk to the doctor and made you feel better. Even if there wasn't anything he could do for you, he'd do it, because they were good doctors and they could. They could just talk and the feeling a little better. Oh yeah, North Point. No, nobody worked there. Oh yeah, Shantipo. Everybody had to work. Everybody had to work because that was the first thing the Japanese told us. He said, live, you have to eat, and he says, if you want to eat, you have to work. There's no fooling around with them at all, you see. So everybody had to work. So the project there was extending the airfield. So we'd be up at 3:30 or 4 o'clock in the morning, cold and dark, and we'd stumble down to the boat and take this cold boat ride around the bend to get to the airfield. And then we start hauling dirt. We chopped down a mountain there and then extended the airfield. But when the boys made the cement, they did a little sabotage work. That was a wicked. But everybody worked there. I was working beside a bank president, a civilian. Hong Kong, yeah. And a number of well-educated, well-off men were working there. And I never did know why, because they were civilians. And I don't know why they were there. I never did find out. They had the civilian compound. One compound for the women and another for the men. And I guess afterward they would go back to the compound, if that's what they call it. Yeah, it was the same. And we'd go back to ours. But it was a rough deal. And they were miserable to us in the camp. The camp interpreter was a product of Winnipeg. He went to St. John's High School. And I think to prove his loyalty, he had to be extra mean to the boys. One day I was just walking up this cement walk, and there was water or something. For some reason I had to step off the sidewalk and walk and just go around it, step on the grass and go up. I go, here comes this guy roaring up this interpreter. What are you doing walking on the grass or something? I think that's what he said. He started to holler. So he slapped me a few times and off he went. I still dazed. I couldn't figure out what happened. A buddy taught me in the perfect English. Some of the boys knew him from school. No. Yeah, that's not the one, because this guy is from Winnipeg. North End. Well, he went over there before the war. I don't know if he went out there with a purpose in mind in joining up or not. But he was an officer interpreter. When we were in Champs-de-Paul, when we first got there, there was a big newsstand, and they sold goodies, you know, sheets and papers, and the guy that run it was a real friendly guy, real friendly, jovial, you know, and happy, and a real pal, and everybody liked him. By golly, when we got back to that camp as prisoners, this guy's an officer in the Japanese Army. He's a Japanese. We wouldn't know a Japanese, you know, if we've seen one, of course, you see. But this guy that operated this stand, he's a Japanese all the time. Sure, oh yeah, finding everything out. real friendly type. Oh, he's something. But at Champs-de-Paul, we used to have sing songs at night. There was a number of Englishmen there, and they're great for singing. They're great for singing and telling stories and things. And we had one man in our outfit that was a beautiful singer, Geddes. I forget his first name, but his last name was Geddes, and he had a beautiful voice, and he sang all the time. And the Englishman would sing all the time. So after work, we'd sit outside over and, you know, we'd sing, and we had a paddy there and the whole circus. Oh, no. But while we were in that Champs-de-Paul, two or three times, there was a raid from the Taggers. Nationalists, Chinese nationalists. What were those? They were called the Flying Tigers or something. But they were just a nuisance raid because they just flew over and dropped a bomb here or there, and that's all, and then that's it. And the Japanese, I don't think they're worried at all. And then there was always a rumor that Kai Shek was coming. He was on the way all the time, but he never did get there. There was a lot of rumors going around, but I think rumors is actually a good thing in one way, even if they're made up, because there has to be some hope, and if the rumors are good rumors, well, there's no harm done, and eventually it'll cheer you up for a while. That's quite a thing. Only waiting for Chai Shek to come. No. No, I didn't know that. The only time I thought a twinge, mind you, only a twinge, is when I moved, bought this house. Paid a lot of money down for the house, and I just settled in nicely, and two houses away moved in a Japanese family. And only for just for a short, I had some misgivings. But after that, we made friends and made good friends. No. Only the sick people that were quite sick, they had to go. And we were all examined. And anybody that could stand up and walk around and looked alive, they had to go to work in Japan. So there was two train loads started off, and we went by boat in the very bottom of a boat, which was a horrible experience because everything was so crowded and hot and but we managed to get there, and we boarded a train to Nagasaki. And we just stepped on the dock at Nagasaki. It took us about 5 minutes, and across the bay, not too far away, is a huge factory. And while we're standing there looking at it, it blew up. Boom, just like that, blew up. So who do you think the Japs are mad at? Us. They think we had something to do with it. But strange coincidence. While we're there looking at it, it blows up. So, no, we didn't hear, no, but the Japanese were really mad at us. But one thing that caught our attention were huge stockpiles of lead blocks made in USA. Huge. All the way down these big piers, tons of it. Big trucks made in USA, stacked them all the way down these big piers, everything USA. Of course, they're purchased probably, no doubt. No. Well, yes, but they're all censored, of course. We never knew for sure what was going on because we got some news in the camp. Of course, we never knew how true it was because there was a rumor that one of the Englishmen had a radio and we used to hear some news from that. But, so I just say it was all bad news at the time, though. That's the only thing. Oh, yeah. Everything was falling there, and it was real bad news. So it was just as well. But, where? Nagasaki. In the not Nagasaki. Well, the first stop in Japan, I think it was in Nagasaki. Yeah. And then from there we went to work in a shipyard. This camp was better. It was cleaner, of course. It was cleaner. It was right in the city of Japan, so there should be no reason why it should be as bad as some of the other ones in Hong Kong. But it was cleaner, and the camp was cleaner, there's no doubt. But the food was just barely enough to get along on, and that's all. Well, the ones that didn't have to go to work, there's always sick people all the time, you see, and the people that were sick, they cleaned up the
floored and so on. But it was cleaner, which was a big help. And not only that, but they had a big bath there that we could have a bath once a week. And that helped a lot. Oh no, nothing. And the camp convict at that particular camp, he was well educated and spoke English well, and he was a good gentleman, I think. But he had to work quite hard at this place. That was the first. That was a shipyard that American come over and bombed. His name, I forget his name now. And that was the shipyard for a little bit of the sabotage was done by one of the staff sergeants. But it was hard work there. It was hard work because the diet wasn't conducive to hard work. And if you don't have a proper diet, you get pretty weak. Staff Sergeant McNaughton. He wasn't a grenadier. He was attached to the grenadiers and they understood that he did some sabotage work in the plant, but he received a medal for it. And we stayed there for a while, and then we went up north to the coal mines, up in the northern part. It was quite cool up around that area. And there was a place where we first got there, we had to stand outside for all afternoon, stripped naked while we got our work clothes. And then there's an awful feeling going down into a mouth of the mine, of a coal mine. This is way down deep. All that is a G-string. It's so hot. And we worked on the coal face. As soon as they explode the dynamite, we had to go in and clear it up and load it on the truck. And we had to load so many trucks per shift. I don't know how many it was, 30 or 40? And there, no excuse, you had to stay there until that was, until your allotment was done. And then you could go. But it was dangerous work because so many cracks, you'd hear a crack and you'd run because, it'd fall down. You'd start caving in. But it was bad work anyway because it's damp, a certain amount of moisture, and then all this gas from the coal, dust and everything. And that was a pretty rough deal. And then once you go outside, you'd go there later, that time of day, it'd be so cold. You'd be sweating, you see, and go out, it'd be so cold. Don't freeze to death. And then the camp would be cold, and so it was. Oh, yeah. And we worked there for a long time, and then all of a sudden, one day we heard these planes fly over. A bunch of Americans in their small fighter planes. And they flew over the camp upside down, and they dropped us notes on their wrenches and stuff. Flew over down a little slope there and machine gunned the Japs down there and off they went again. Well, they do this every so often. Come along, drop his stuff and turn over and the side machine gun these jokers. And that went on for quite a while. And then one day, by golly, we woke up and you couldn't find a Japanese to save your soul. Not one in sight. Not one in the whole camp. So we walked around and
And then our officers, of course, took over the authority and NCOs, and before we knew it, the plane came over and dropped us messages that would be the representatives coming around to see us, arranging for our passage down to the city and so on. So in the meantime, they're flying over these big bombers, dropping us food and clothing and stuff like that, and these big steel drums. And it was really something. See, where is the boots that I got that they dropped to me? The big high boots. And I still have the jacket. American boots, oh yeah. They're all American, yeah. And then they took us down by train to Tokyo. And huge canteen there, so they handed us big bags. They said, okay, boys, anything you see, go and take. Help yourself. Oh, yeah. We didn't. Nobody really did, you know. And then and we're sitting around outside talking out there, and this guy came up and talked to us. The shirt sleeves rolled up. He sat there talking to him. He said, well, goodbye, boys. He said, goodbye. Off we went. So he walks up this United States guard. He says, hey, do you know your talking to? I said, no. And he said, no, he said, well, it's a three-star general. But we couldn't tell because he had put on a soft hat, you see, and a sleeve rolled up. How are we going to know who he is? And he never said nothing. A three-star general. So they're, well, boys, we'd like you to march onto the battleship, Iowa. So, by golly, we marched down there as best as we could. Oh yeah, chocolate and stuff like that. And this cans of stuff and the goodness on the battleship and the telephone. For a day or so, yeah. And they set us up and treated us and stuff. Boy, they looked good, those Americans. And they had a band on board, they played, they were some sort of pictures, and they asked anybody who wanted to fly home, they'd fly home. If you want to go home by boat, they can go home by boat. So, my brother and I was still home. Oh yes, yeah. While we were in the coal mine, on this particular shift, everything was shaking all around the place. We thought, well, it's an earthquake or something. We didn't know what to see, and the guards didn't know. But the next shift, the next time we seen the guards, they said that the United States would drop a big firebomb and burn up a city or two. And one of the guards said, well, it won't be long before the war is over. And it was great, too. Because not long after that, we woke up and there wasn't a Japanese sight. And we just took charge of everything. Well, these guards were wounded naval veterans. And they went to... happy with their job, I don't think. And we're still their enemy, I guess. And they're kind of mean. But they were wounded veterans. I guess they have a right to be wounded veterans. Oh, yes. But they were all right. They were nice. They had no knife or grinder. And they were all right. And they were hungry,
they had to work for everything they got, and they never had a lot of food at all. And they just lived on fish and rice and vegetables. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Fine. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. First day. Yeah. No. No complaints at all. No complaints. Oh yeah. Oh. Well, I'm as good the health to be as to be expected, but my nerves are bad. My well, you know, the ailments. I think most of the boys have got the same ailments, more or less. That's what the doctor's saying. And I'm looking after myself. I don't drink, I don't smoke, and I look after myself. Sure, and well, that's the only way to fight it, because if you don't look after yourself with these ailments, you know, you're not going to last too long. And it's just a matter of what you want out of life. Oh, absolutely, yes. Oh, yes, 100%. Well, I don't know. I can just speak for myself in that case. I've got a good job and I'm making good money. Sending half of it back to Ottawa in taxes. But the treatment that we receive from DVA and Deer Lodge has been absolutely first class. No complaints at all. Absolutely not. So, as far as I'm concerned, there's not a thing in the world that I can complain about at all about the treatment that we received when we got back at all. And we've been doing everything possible for us, medically, you know, financially too. Yeah. There's no doubt about it that a large number of the men have become antisocial. Which means they feel more secure in their own homes, and they don't like going out too much. And they don't like associating with other people too often, as I think we had our fill of that, you know, 4.5 years being closely confined with other men during hard times. But I believe that that's the attitude that a lot of them have. Of course, there's some that is not, but I think you find that most of them have. They're happier in their own home, you know, where it's, you know, the security. So. No. I was a single man with only my mother waiting for me at home, but I'm sure there may be some married men may feel a few qualms. I don't know if that's what you mean. No, I for months, maybe years, before I come home to Canada, I had decided what I was going to do if I ever got back to Canada, and that's exactly what I did. I had already my plans already made. So I did exactly what I had planned to do. And an American story. But only regret is being having this little phobia or something about social life. I don't know, I'm not very in the social world myself. And what the doctors have convinced me that it's just due to my Hong Kong experience. And they said that there's a large number without any family. Yeah. Well, I don't think anybody expected a big welcome back. As it's so nice to get back, who cares? I don't know. I'm not too sure how to answer your question. No. Hey? Yeah. Oh yeah, I have no prejudice at all to you. As I know very well that the people here had nothing to do with the war. And they're the same as anyone else. They're friendly and they work hard and they're kind people. And I've got no prejudice at all. And not only that, but everyone knows how every nation acts during a war. I guess no one is surprised at his brutality and so on during the war. It seems that no nation is exempt from it. So I think the Japanese acted just the same as any other nation did.